This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello and welcome to a special supersized video edition of Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. In addition to hosting this radio program, I also have the privilege of teaching speech classes at Herbert W. Armstrong College, the private college sponsored by the Philadelphia Church of God. That's the same organization that hosts Trumpet Radio. This past Sunday, February 14th, we held our annual speech banquet. This is one of a handful of formal events the college holds each year. It's always my favorite of these events because we get to hear from the students. In advance of the event, we hold speak-offs and we choose the best of the speeches from the students. We weave them together into a program over the course of a special meal. In the last few years, we've also had a live link with our sister campus in England, so we're enjoying a brunch while they're having a formal dinner. On today's show, for the first time, you will get to enjoy this very special occasion. I served as the master of ceremonies at this year's banquet, and I explain what you're going to hear in my opening remarks, so I won't give those twice. But I will say it's about an hour and a half altogether, 9 top quality speeches given by the students at Armstrong College. Well worth your time to hear them, or to see them in this case. You usually listen to the program, but on this occasion we are posting a video of it at thetrumpet.com. I'd encourage you to watch it if you can. I hope you enjoy the Herbert W. Armstrong College 2021 Speech Banquet. Wisdom is a rare and a wonderful thing. To have wisdom starts with having truth. It starts with discerning what is true and right. And then it is truth exercised. It's true knowledge applied. It's been said that knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting in a fruit salad. In Proverbs 8, wisdom speaks. She cries at the city gates. She calls to the simple. She says, "Hear, for I will speak noble things, and from my lips will come what is right." And then she says in verse 7, "My mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips." Ladies and gentlemen, thankfully, we are part of a spiritual family that exalts wisdom and that speaks truth. It's a refreshing contrast to the world around us, which is increasingly embracing foolishness and exalting lies and accepting fraud and casting truth to the ground. George Orwell said, "In a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act." Students and faculty, we are revolutionaries. We are truth tellers. Our Heavenly Father is the source of wisdom, and His word is truth. He's training us to recognize lies and to expose deceits. He's bringing us up in the way of wisdom, and He's teaching us to exalt truth and to speak truth. This is a pillar principle upon which Herbert W. Armstrong College has been built. Our chancellor has often highlighted the importance of communication to realizing the goals of the college. God doesn't just educate us for our own profit. He gives us this education so we can share it, so that we can teach it, so we can speak it. And the speech banquet gives us an opportunity each year to highlight our speech program and to really showcase how God is cultivating students at His college to become skilled communicators. We're learning not only to live lives of truth, but also to speak truth. Today we're going to hear 3 sets of speeches with 3 speeches in each of them. We'll hear from 9 students who will entertain us, inform us, enlighten us, exhort us, and inspire us by speaking wonderful words of truth. Truth about some of the most important themes in our lives: family, friendship, gratitude,
courage, duty, hope. We're going to learn about overcoming adversity, embracing opportunity, expecting miracles, and cherishing life. The first three speeches teach us about the value of friends and family. They're going to transport us across hundreds of miles and hundreds of years, and then bring us right back to the family that we have here at God's headquarters. Our first speaker today hails from about as far from Edmond, Oklahoma as you can get, all the way from Angeles City in the Philippines, a land of large families, adorable nicknames, exuberant karaoke. This speaker has enough personality and spunk for three people, and she has made a place for herself in all of our hearts. Her speech today well illustrates the adage spoken by George Burns: happiness is having a large, loving, caring, close-knit family in another city. Please help me welcome, for a delightful, entertained speech called Thanksgiving with Jet Jet and Jim Boy, Miss Heidi Rodas.
Who knew that despite of being thousands of miles from home, I actually had family close by? So 2 years ago, I received a phone call from an unknown number. Turns out, it was a relative calling all the way from New York. I don't know how exactly we're related, but in the Philippines, any person around your parents' generation, you call them auntie or uncle. Or in the Philippines, we call aunties tita and uncles titos. Anyway, this tita wanted me to come over to New York for Thanksgiving. And I didn't want to go at first because I barely know them, but they said that they'd pay for my ticket, so I said yes. Little did I know that I had to convince Mr. Burns that these strangers weren't out to kidnap me. But they were nice folks, you know, all Catholics. Our Thanksgiving meal, I learned, was shared between five extended families, all of whom I've never met before. But they were all excited to meet their cousin from Oklahoma. So the first ones that I was introduced to were my cousins Jethro and James, each nicknamed Jet Jet and Jim Boy. Their dad is cousin Bing. I don't know what his real name is. But Bing had another brother named Eduardo Jr., which everyone called Jun Jun. And then I had to share a room with my cousin Christine, which everyone called Tintin. And I couldn't remember everyone's names, but I realized I didn't have to. I could just grab a random syllable, repeat it, and someone for sure will answer to that nickname. Jing Jing, Mon Mon, Mik Mik, Kat Kat, then there's, you know, Big Boy. You know, typical Filipino nicknames. So my titas were all excited to talk to me. I'm not sure about, you know, aunties in the Western world, but Filipino titas, when they talk, they get really excited. So they would, like, three or four titas would come over to me and just ask me questions. Oh, do you have a boyfriend? You have a boyfriend? Don't boyfriend first, huh? Grades before babes. And another tita would come in. Oh, how's your mom? I saw your mom on Facebook. This is how they talk. I saw your mom on Facebook, you know? How's your mom's siblings? You know, how's the younger brother? What's his name? I forgot. You know, the adopted one. I didn't even know my uncle was adopted. So one of the things they were more interested to hear was about the college that I go to in Oklahoma. Now, ask any of my cousins in there where they went to college or, you know, where they're going to college, and they always have quick, straight answers. Oh, NYU, City College of New York. Oh, New Jersey Institute of Technology. So they would ask me, like, how about you, Heidi? So I was like, I go to this, like, small private, you know, college called Herbert W. Armstrong College, and it's a liberal arts college. We study about, oh, no, Tita, it's not painting. It's not painting. It's liberal arts, but it's not painting. And then they would ask me, so what's your major, Heidi? Well, what do you major in? Said, well, you know, we study different things. We study history, communication. What's that, Tita? Oh, Mom said I'm a music student. Oh, well, I'm in the choir. But before things get really awkward, you know, one of my many uncles in the room, he coughed to grab our attention to let us know that dinner was served. So just like how God parted the Red Sea, the people standing in front of the dining room table parted, showing a whole spit roast pig on the table. So I said, thanks, Tito, as I surveyed the table for anything, I mean anything I could eat. Prawns, veggie stir fry, those have shrimp, spring rolls. And I also, as I was about to bite it, and then one said, oh, that's Cousin Jing Jing's famous pork spring rolls, and I put it down. Look for more food in the table, and I saw a plate of rice cakes, like, yeah, rice cakes. But as I was busy looking for something else to eat, one of my tita had a microphone in her hand. And then she came running into the room and said, Jet, the karaoke is ready, call your cousins! But Jet was busy listening to Tito Ed debate with Cousin Bing about Trump. Turns out, Tito Ed was pro-Trump, but my Cousin Bing, he was a Democrat. Oh no! But since it seems like karaoke wouldn't start until the debate died down, I just waited in the living room. And I sat next to a Caucasian lady who was married to one of my cousins. She asked me what I thought of Thanksgiving, so I had to tell her. I told her that when I was invited for Thanksgiving the year before that, I thought that Americans had to wear either a Native American costume or a pilgrim costume. Not only that, I also thought that they had to sing God Bless America by the bonfire or the fireplace after the meal. So, of course, they laughed at my ignorance. But what followed was probably the most solemn part of the evening. You see, instead of starting the karaoke party with my uncle's rendition of Frank Sinatra's My Way, we started singing God Bless America. I love my family in New York, but at that moment, singing with my relatives around the fireplace, the fake fireplace, made me miss home. And by home, I meant Edmond, Oklahoma. It's weird how a place so far from the Philippines would be called home, but it is, because a big chunk of my family lives there, here. Spending Thanksgiving 1,400 miles from home made me all the more thankful for the family I found in Oklahoma. I have three things I learned to be more thankful for. Number one, in a church potluck, everything is kosher. The second one, there's no need to explain what liberal arts is. A well-rounded, godly education, that's standard. And the third one, which is probably one of the more important ones, no political argument will ever get in the way of karaoke. You know, in a few months, I'll most likely be missing everyone 8,000 miles away from home, across the Pacific. So please, let me use this chance to thank everyone who has been part of my family this 3 years. You might be 10 feet away from home, 100 meters from home, or like me, thousands of miles away from home. But look around the room. Family might be closer than you think.
I'm going to introduce the next two speeches, both of them from sophomores here at God's College, and they'll carry on with this theme of colorful and lively relationships. Of all the family bonds that we enjoy, none is sweeter than a happy marriage. We're going to hear about one marriage of people that you have likely met. You've probably had dinner with them. It's a marriage that's built on service, and it's sustained by miracles. We're going to hear a message that will have you laughing, even as it teaches you several lessons about how to navigate life's challenges And it's always more rewarding when we do it together. So for the third speech in this set, we'll hear a very sweet and touching biography speech called Everybody Needs Something, given to us by Mr. Jordan Saranga. But before that, we'll hear about another unusual pair. This from two centuries ago, two men who were literally revolutionaries and truth tellers. Sometimes being brutally truthful can test the strength of a friendship. It's been said that real friends don't get offended when you insult them. They smile and call you something even more offensive. But these two men were known to exchange some pretty pointed barbs at one another. They worked together during a turbulent time that strained the bond to the breaking point. But they managed to forge a friendship that really has a valuable message for us, to give us a very entertaining historic speech titled Founding Frenemies. Please welcome Mr. Micah Turgeon.
Thank you, Mr. Hilliker, and good morning, students and faculty. They were the best of friends. They were the bitterest of enemies. Over 230 years ago, two of America's greatest founding fathers became the nation's favorite frenemies. Today, I'm going to tell you how we can use the example of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson to fix our personal relationships. The Adams-Jefferson relationship started off strong. They met at the Second Continental Congress in 1775, and a year later, Adams personally selected Thomas Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. Later on, you'll hear more about the wonderful start and finish of their friendship, but I'm going to tell you all the dirt in between. By 1789, everything was just dandy. America was fully independent from England. George Washington had just been unanimously elected president, and everyone was happy. Until the French Revolution. You see, Adams and Jefferson had extremely different opinions on the integrity of the French Revolution. Jefferson was a huge Frenchie. He loved everything France. And he viewed their revolution as similar to America's, quote, a struggle which was necessary. Adams, on the other hand, instead of seeing a noble struggle, saw a hot mess. He viewed their revolution the same, completely dissimilar to the American Revolution. Reading of heads rolling in the streets of Paris, Adams wrote to his cousin, quote, everything will be pulled down, but what will be built up? The isolated disagreement over the French Revolution started small, not the biggest of issues, but the way that each man handled this situation blew it way out of proportion. And this is where things start to get spicy. In 1791, well-known activist Thomas Paine wrote The Rights of Man, which was a commentary supporting the French Revolution. Jefferson loved this book, and he gave it to an American printer to distribute The Rights of Man in America. However, Jefferson sent along a little note to the printer, saying that Paine's book would disprove, quote, the political heresies that have sprung up among us. Now this was an indirect but obvious dig at Adams. When the press caught wind of the note, they began labeling Adams as a monarchist, which was probably the worst thing you could call a person at that time, similar to being called a racist today. For months, Adams and Jefferson said nothing to each other as the press went wild over these accusations, and the rift between the two grew wider. Jefferson eventually sent an apology letter to Adams, but he never really took full responsibility for his actions, rather blaming it on the printer, blaming it on the press, and so forth. Adams responded, quote, it is high time that you and I should come to an explanation with each other. Sadly, that explanation didn't happen. Fast forward to 1796, and both men are running for president. If you thought things were bad before, throw a presidential campaign into it, and things get dialed up to 11. A pro-Jefferson newspaper dubbed Adams, quote, his rotundity, and revived his monarchist label. Meanwhile, Adams' supporters, most notably among them Alexander Hamilton, publicized rumors about an illicit relationship with Jefferson and his slave Sally Hemings. When the dust settled in 1796, Adams narrowly defeated Jefferson for the presidency. Afterwards, Adams tried to make amends by offering Jefferson the vice presidency. At that point, neither man wanted anything to do with each other, but Jefferson accepted for the good of the country. This decision was purely political, though, and the two men basically gave each other the silent treatment for the better part of the next 4 years. At the end of the term, Jefferson told others that Adams never, quote, consulted me as to any measures of the government. Now, it's the year 1800, and things are about to get a whole lot uglier. Adams and Jefferson run against each other again for the presidency, and this time around, neither man's going to pull any punches. Enter James Callender. Now, Callender was a salacious journalist. For the right price, Callender would write the worst hit pieces on politicians that you could imagine. He was basically the TMZ of the 18th century. Long story short, don't mess with James Callender. Unfortunately for Adams, he became one of Callender's targets. Callender called Adams one of the most egregious fools upon the continent, that strange compound of ignorance and ferocity, of deceit and weakness. He was Scottish, by the way. He even started rumors that Adams was a hermaphrodite. You heard that correctly. He wasn't a hermaphrodite, don't worry. Meanwhile, Adams' supporters reciprocated the love by calling Jefferson an atheist, a coward, and reviving the rumors about Sally Hemings. Now, Jefferson wound up winning the 1800 election, and he and Adams were estranged for more than a decade afterwards. Adams didn't even attend Jefferson's inauguration. Their once close friendship was dead. But in 1812, everything changed. Adams decided to reach out to Jefferson, and he sent him a little note wishing Jefferson success in the years ahead. And Jefferson responded, quote, "A letter from you calls up recollections very dear to my mind." Over the next 14 years, both men would exchange 158 letters with each other. In these letters, they finally came to a full explanation with each other, as Adams had suggested over 20 years earlier. And the older these men got, the cuter their letters got. This is what Jefferson wrote in 1823. "Crippled wrists and fingers make writing slow and laborious. But while writing to you, I lose the sense of these things in the recollection of ancient times when youth and health made happiness out of everything." That's pretty cute. So what can we learn from the frenemies that were Adams and Jefferson? Well, their example teaches us how to overlook differences. For about 20 years, all these men did was focus on the faults of one another. It's the game of politics. You gotta make yourself look better than the other guy. But what started as a small difference of opinion grew into something much bigger and uncontrollable. If we're not careful, the same things can happen to us. We can focus in on that one little obnoxious thing that another person does. Then eventually you see two obnoxious things that person does. And then several things, until you really can't stand being in the same room with that person. That's what happened with Adams and Jefferson. But how did they fix their issues? They chose to focus on the positives. They chose to write about what they did agree on, what they liked about each other. Adams and Jefferson proved that no matter how broken a friendship may appear, it can always be saved. Philippians 4 verse 8 says, "If there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. No matter who we're in a class with or who we're roommates with, there's always something good about that person." We see what we look for, good or bad. If you look for the worst in people, you'll even make up things that don't exist to be annoyed with them. I mean, the Pharisees did this with Jesus Christ. He was the only perfect individual ever, and they found so many faults with him. So be like Adams and Jefferson. Look for the positives in one another, and never, ever let the French Revolution divide your friendships.
Good morning, everyone, and hello, good afternoon over in Edstone. Once the cold gets you, it's hard to get it out. Back in the 1960s, a young man was driving his 1961 Jeep Wrangler out with his friends. Suddenly, a little teenage girl ran out into the street directly in front of him. And he resolved that there would be consequences. So he drove donuts around her for at least 5 minutes before driving off. By chance, they met probably half an hour later and were introduced. Once again, this young man resolved he would marry this girl. And he did. Cecil Ray Kirby and Marilyn Garner were married. And that marriage has lasted over 50 years. I guess you could say that they needed each other. So today I want to show you why you need to hear the Kirby's story. The Kirbys came into the WCG between the 70s and 80s. Mrs. Kirby came in the mid-70s, and it was 12 long years before Mr. Kirby followed suit. But he was hostile at first, but after 12 years, he saw fruits, and he saw that it was right, and that his wife knew where the truth was. So he followed her into the WCG, and this is where their incredible story begins. In the early 70s, they had moved to Kansas, and here in Kansas, they really learned how to serve. They bought a farm, and instantly, within the church, their home became a base of operations. They held parties. They had events there. They held services there. But they really focused on serving God's people as best they could. So for, I don't even know how long, but decades, for decades, they used their home to serve God's people. They had the outreach there. Many of you have probably been to the Kirby Farm in Kansas. And you just know how hospitable they are. You know, they try to make this millennial setting for everyone. And there are always lots of pancakes. And there's this great music. But they really strive to serve. And they set an incredible example there. And then finally, in 2017, they were given the opportunity to move to Edmond, Oklahoma. This is something they had wanted and prayed about for years and years. And finally, they were given that opportunity. And they used that, and they took it, and they grew even more. They bought a house here, and instantly, they added a whole nother room just so they could invite more and more people over. They were in, I think they've had almost every student over to their house at some point. They were able to have the Flurries over, like Mr. Gerald Flurry and his wife too. They've had so many ministers over, but the point is they just really love serving so much. But at the same time, they're a persevering couple, and they've been shaped by so many trials and so many miracles, and I just want to share one of those stories with you. So the Kirbys make it a goal to have people over to their house, but they weren't getting enough elderly people, specifically handicapped people, over to their house with wheelchairs. So they needed a ramp to accomplish this because they have a staircase up to their house. It was impossible to build a ramp around their house so they could get a wheelchair up to their front door. So the next best thing is a ramp, a handicap ramp. And to find one of those brand new is $7,000. Used, half that price, but still, a few thousand dollars is just way over the top. So Mr. Kirby prayed that he could find some sort of handicap lift. He prayed, I don't know how long he was looking for one, but probably a while. It's hard to come by a handicap lift. However, nearby his house, somebody was having a junk sale, as you often see in Edmond, Oklahoma. And he stopped by just to see if there was anything he might possibly need. He didn't see anything, so he went home empty-handed. But then he remembered the next day he saw some pipe that he could have used. So he went back. He asked the man there, do you still have that pipe? The man said it was gone. However, there were more things inside that he could take a look at, although they would cost him a little more money. So Mr. Kirby said, you don't have the pipe I need, so I don't think I'll stick around. The man said, everybody needs something. Just tell me what you need. So Mr. Kirby, he didn't tell him anything, but he reluctantly went inside the man's home. He looked around, but still didn't see anything that he needed. So he was about to leave. The man said, come on, everybody needs something. So tell me what you need. Mr. Kirby was finished. This man had wasted enough of his time, so he was about to head home and sit back in his recliner or build another shed. He's always busy. But the man said one more time, "Everybody needs something. Tell me what you need." And Mr. Kirby looked at him, and he admitted, "I need a handicapped lift." The man pointed, and he said, "There's one right next to you." There was a piece of sheet metal between Mr. Kirby and this handicapped lift, but the man walked over, lifted it, and right there, a handicapped lift for a wheelchair. The man said, "I'll give it to you for $250. Now, you can't pay with a card if you're at a junk sale. So Mr. Kirby needed cash. He raced home as quickly as he could. He went to his dresser, and he took out his emergency fund, which was exactly $250 in cash. And he went back, and he bought that lift. And then this man, if you know him, you know he's made of steel and grit. But he sat back in his recliner, and he cried. Because all he wanted to do was to better serve his brothers and sisters. And God had given him the most detailed miracle, the most specific miracle anyone could ask for. It was more than he could ask for. It was beyond that. So if there's anything I've learned from the Kirbys, it's that you persevere through your trials, and you rely on God for miracles, and you never stop relying on him. But something else I learned from this story is that everybody needs something. Mr. Kirby needed that wheelchair lift, but what he needed more was to serve. He needs that. And almost 20 years ago, the Kirbys suffered a trial where Mr. Kirby, he had Alzheimer's. I don't know the details. It's hard to explain Alzheimer's. But he was miraculously healed because Mrs. Kirby went to God and she said, "I need a husband. I've lived with him for almost my entire life. I don't know if I can live without him. I need that." And God heard that and he answered. So what do you need? Everybody needs something. Maybe you need to talk to people like the Kirbys. Maybe you need to hear their stories about their miracles, about their trials, and how they push through and persevere and rely on God. Here's the thing, we don't always know what we need. But when we talk to people like the Kirbys and the other elderly, the seniors in the congregation, those who have suffered but persevered, we can learn so much that we would have never expected. So next time you see the Kirbys, ask them about the wheelchair lift, about how they met, about their experience in the WCG. Ask others about their experiences too, because you might find that you needed something and you just didn't know it.
The next three speeches will highlight some of the most honorable virtues we can exhibit. Duty, honor, courage under fire, defiance in the face of evil. Henry David Thoreau said in his book Walden, "Rather than love, than money, than fame, give me truth." Truth is supremely valuable, and yet in a world of deceit, living a life of truth and speaking truth can turn you into a target. You must be resolute and determined to defend truth at all costs, to say that when men are speaking lies, when injustice is about to prevail, when the wicked silence the innocent, my mouth shall speak truth. The second speech that we're going to hear is set during the dark days of Nazi oppression in World War II. It's an inspiring story of a man who was willing to risk his life to stand against villainy. I'm very excited to hear from this speaker, an Armstrong College junior I've been very impressed with, and just watching him grow tremendously during his time here at God's College, giving a speech titled Righteous Among the Nations. We will hear from Mr. William Wallace. But before that, we'll hear a speech taking us back even to an earlier war, the American Civil War. This was the deadliest conflict in our nation's history. And it was fought to preserve a union that lived up to its founding truth, that all men are created equal. Today we're being fed the lie that this nation is irredeemably racist, that even its flag is a symbol of oppression. But this is a story of true heroism, a black man who believed in this nation and did his utmost to fulfill his duty to this nation. And it's a speech titled, Hold the Flag High. Please help me welcome a freshman at Herbert W. Armstrong College, Miss Erica Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Hilliker, and hello, everyone. In the spring of 1863, Governor John Andrew recruited the 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry Regiment. This was the first military unit consisting of black soldiers in the North during the Civil War. And born as a slave, there was one man in this unit by the name of William Kearny. The 54th fought in many operations during the Civil War, but one battle that valiantly stands out in history is the battle at Fort Wagner. And Kearny would distinguish himself in a remarkable way. So today, I will share a story of one man's dedication to true patriotism. During the Civil War, there were battle flags carried by a soldier known as color bearers, and their job was extremely important because they had to keep the flags remaining high and visible to the army during the battle. The main duty of a flag was to serve as a rallying point for troops on the battlefield. And it was also a symbol of pride as it lifted the morale of the soldiers. Colored flags were practical too, because when soldiers were fighting, when they saw that the color of their flag, which represented their unit, they knew that if they were wounded or they needed to restock their supplies, that they would just have to follow and make their way to that flag. And that would provide their safety and their refuge. Flags were the center point of every unit and the most important physical attribute to a soldier. However, color bearers didn't really carry weapons very often, so their likeliness of being shot or wounded was pretty high. And if a color bearer was shot down, then a member of his guard would have to come back and just immediately pick up the flag and keep on marching. Because that was their duty. That is what they signed up for. After many skirmishes and forced march with little food and 24 hours with no rest, the regimental commander, Colonel Robert Shaw, requested the perilous honor of leading the Confederates on this attack at Fort Wagner. And on July 18, 1863, William Kearny and his regiment spearheaded an attack on Morris Island, South Carolina. With bayonets in hand, 600 of the men of the 54th, they advanced, and they sustained their charge until they reached the top of the fortified wall, where, unfortunately, their commander, Colonel Shaw, was mortally wounded. During this intense battle, the 54th, they were hit by a barrage of canister, musketry, and shelling, and several of the 54th's color bearers were shot down. As a bullet struck one of the color bearers and he was about to collapse from pain, Kearny threw down his weapon and he immediately picked up the flag, never letting it touch the ground. He held it in his upright position and he continued to press forward, pressing his wound with one hand and upholding that emblem of freedom with the other. He soon found himself alone, surrounded by wounded and dead bodies of the comrades. But he continued to hold that flag resolute while bullets and shell fragments peppered the sand around him. Although badly wounded and utterly exhausted, Kearny made it back to the federal lines with Old Glory safely in hand. And with that flag secure, he reportedly told his comrades, quote, "Boys, I only did my duty. The old flag never touched the ground." For his incredible gallantry and determination to fulfill his job, Kearny was awarded the Medal of Honor, which is the United States military's highest declaration for valor. And he received this award on May 23, 1900. As a self-liberated man, Sergeant William Kearny understood the commission he signed up for, and he made it his goal to fulfill that purpose. He took his job seriously because it was his life. In the face of relentless enemy fire, Carney suffered 4 serious gunshot wounds. But despite the pain, he never let the Stars and Stripes fall to the ground. And that Medal of Honor awarded to him reflects his courageous and ambitious actions because he went above and beyond the call of duty. Churchill said, "Fear is a reaction. Courage is a decision." William Carney did not fear getting shot, being wounded, or even dying. He knew that signing up for war meant the possibility of sacrificing his life, and he was okay with that. He knew that fighting for the struggle of freedom was worthwhile. His mindset envisioned it. His actions proved it. And his dedication made him successful. And we too must envision to know the struggle is worthwhile. Because we all struggle. We all go through trials, physically or spiritually. And it's up to us. Are we going to react with fear and be a coward? Or are we going to decide to have that courage to push and overcome? Carney's dedication to that duty allowed him to face Fort Wagner with courage. And that unwavering courage drove him with determination to never let the American flag fall to the ground, that symbol of true patriotism. "He that endures until the end shall be saved," Christ said. So never let down. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. So remember what spiritual nation or flag that you stand for. Hold fast. Stand resolute. Stay loyal to your regiment and never, never, never let your flag touch the ground.
Thank you, Mr. Hilliker, and good morning, everybody. If you saw an injustice happen, what would you do? Would you just stand idly by out of fear of reprisals against you and your family? Or would you step out and take a stand, knowing that if you were caught or called on it, you would stand to lose everything you had worked for your entire life, your family, your career, and possibly even your life? Well, that's exactly what one German army officer did in the Second World War. He saw injustice, and he stood up for what was right. Today, I would like to inspire you through the story of Albert Battelle. He was born in 1891 in Kleinpramsen, Germany, which is now a part of Poland. He fought gallantly on the German side in the First World War and was awarded the Iron Cross for his actions. And in 1925, he became a lawyer. Fast forward 8 years to 1933, and with it comes Adolf Hitler, the Nazi Party, and a whole host of sick anti-Semitic regulations aimed at dehumanizing the Jews. Being a lawyer, Battelle was tasked with the seizure of the Jewish assets and transferring them over to the ownership of the German state. But in his first act of defiance against this, Battelle refused. Instead, he helped his Jewish lawyer friends escape, keeping their assets in their names and helping them escape the country along with their assets. Obviously, the Germans didn't like this at all. And by 1937, Battelle had his own police file within the Gestapo. After the war, a document was found in there stating that he had, quote, no merit for the Nazi Party. But despite all this, Battelle was allowed to continue to practice law. And in 1942, at the ripe old age of 51, he was drafted into the army and posted to Przemysl, Poland. And soon after being posted there, he loudly voiced his opposition to the Nazi deportation of over 1,000 Jewish adolescents. You think about that. He didn't just stand back and think to himself, this is wrong, but if I say something, they'll kill me. No, he went right up to the SS and loudly voiced his opposition right to their face. about what he thought of their actions. And surprisingly, the SS did nothing about it. They merely branded him with the title Friend of the Jews. But it was a few months later, in July of 1942, an event happened where Battelle's star would shine the brightest. He caught wind of an SS plot to deport the Jews from Przemysl to the Belzec extermination camp. And this was too much for him. This was something that he could not stand to watch. He couldn't stand idly by and just allow this to happen. So on July the 26th, he moved his soldiers into position, blocking the only railway bridge going in and out of Przemysl. On July the 27th, the SS showed up to conduct their deportation. They rolled up to the railway bridge and demanded that Battelle stand aside. But he refused. He stood resolutely, like a brick wall, and even threatened to open fire on the SS. This is unprecedented. You have the rank and file German army and the SS pointing guns at each other. This is unprecedented. This has never happened before. The SS commander, Martin Fellens, confronted Battelle and Battelle's commander-in-chief, Max Leitke, at their army headquarters. He demanded that they stand aside or else face the consequences for their actions. But Battelle still refused, and Battelle's commander, Max Leitke, refused to order Battelle to move as well. And then Battelle took it one step further. He didn't just block the bridge, but in the midst of this exchange, he rounded up a number of his troops and grabbed as many transport trucks as he could find. And he raced into the ghetto and started rounding up as many Jews as he could. He stuffed them into the back of the transport trucks and brought them back to the army headquarters. All in all, Battelle saved about 500 men, women, and children in this one operation. Battelle kept these Jews that he saved under army protection in the basement of the army headquarters. He fed them for the next 2 weeks and gave them food and water, everything they needed to survive. The SS was ultimately forced to back down. They left the bridge because they did not want to risk confrontation with the German army, as it would set a very bad example to the occupied peoples in Poland. Battelle kept them there for about 2 weeks until the coast was clear, and he was finally able to release them. Some of them fled to other parts of Europe, and some of the others Battelle was able to keep around the army base under the guise of doing necessary work for the German army. But this whole incident cost Battelle extremely. Unbeknownst to him, there was two investigations. The first was the SS. The SS investigated him for doing this. The correspondence with the affair about this whole affair went as high as Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, and Martin Bormann, Adolf Hitler's personal secretary. They had both resolved that Battelle would be executed once the war was completed. The German army also had its own internal investigation, and they brought down extremely harsh measures on Battelle. He was relieved of his command, his pay was suspended, he was thrown in prison, and to add insult to injury, the Iron Cross that he had earned for bravery in the First World War was revoked. This is extremely harsh punishment for a man who only tried his hardest to help the Jews, to help the people who were disenfranchised and victims of genocide. The only thing that perhaps protected Battelle from even harsher treatment was a friend of his in the army, General Eugene Schwarzthal. Schwarzthal was able to secure Battelle's release from prison and secure his passage back to Germany, where Battelle sat out the rest of the war. But it was after the war that Battelle really fell on hard times. The denazification trials in post-war Germany were not kind to him. His own fellow lawyers testified against him, saying that he had profited from the seizure of the Jewish assets, which was a complete and total lie. He hadn't profited one bit from it. And none of the Jews that he had saved during the war were able to come to his defense. The state of post-war Germany was a mess. Battelle's license to practice law was revoked. He obtained a job at a glass factory after the war. And then he died in obscurity in 1952 from heart disease, unrecognized for his actions during the war. It wasn't until 1981, almost 30 years later, where his name was finally cleared. Yad Vashem is an organization in Israel that dedicates itself to honoring non-Jews who aided the Jewish cause during the Second World War. They recognized him for his service. And on January the 22nd, 1981, Battelle was finally recognized for his service. He was posthumously awarded Righteous Among the Nations. Battelle stood up and he did the right thing. He stood up against an oppressive evil that was bent on exterminating the Jews. And in so many ways, ladies and gentlemen, we are doing the exact same thing. We're standing up against Satan, an evil being who has his own final solution for mankind, regardless of race, creed, or nationality. So, ladies and gentlemen, never forget the story of Albert Battelle. He fought against evil the best that he humanly could. Not for glory, not for money, but to save lives. So let this man be a motivation to all of us as we continue on this path of world liberation.
Thank you very much. America's first president, George Washington, said, "True friendship is a plant of slow growth and must undergo and withstand the shocks of adversity before it is entitled to the appellation." We've already been introduced to this remarkable true friendship during this speech banquet, this friendship that withstood the shocks of adversity, this friendship between two of President Washington's fellow founders. But it's an example worthy of a closer look, a more intimate look, to help us to see how we can forge genuinely true friendships amid the adversity that we face. What you're about to hear is a very moving heart-to-heart speech set against the backdrop of history. It's titled Our 1776 Moment. Please help me welcome a freshman at God's College, Mr. Jude Fleury.
Thank you, Mr. Hilliker. Good morning, everyone. It's the most famous scene in American history. A few dozen men gathered around a small table. On the table, a piece of paper. And on the paper, a heading. In Congress, July 4th, 1776. Each man in the Pennsylvania State House that day was committing treason against the most powerful nation on earth. And the penalty for treason was death. They knew that. But not a single man in there hesitated to sign the Declaration of Independence. Just above the 56 signatures was the immortal final clause of the Declaration. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. More than a political document, the Declaration of Independence was a binding covenant of loyalty, camaraderie, and friendship. Note that they pledged themselves not to their country, but to each other. For them, the Declaration was an expression of the extraordinary surge of esprit de corps that they mutually referred to decades later as the Spirit of 76. Today, I'd like to share two parallel stories that show how we form unbreakable friendships by overcoming obstacles together. The first story is about two men who perhaps did more than anyone else to conjure the spirit of 76. One was a fiery Massachusetts lawyer named John Adams. The other, a modest, subdued Virginia plantation owner, Thomas Jefferson. Though differing widely in background, status, opinion, even in age. They shared a passionate commitment to the cause of American independence. Together, they faced the challenge of winning the other delegates at the Second Continental Congress to their way of thinking. Adams, with his unmatched eloquence, Jefferson, with the power of his pen. Each of the 13 American colonies had its own culture, history, political, and economic interests. And according to Adams, getting all of them to support the cause of independence would be as miraculous as getting 13 clocks to strike at precisely the same second. But on July 4th, 1776, that's exactly what happened. For Jefferson and Adams, it was a moment of triumph that put an iron seal on their friendship. By striving to make 13 clocks strike at precisely the same second, they had unknowingly aligned their own clocks, which now ticks softly in perfect synchronization. Well, a few weeks ago, to begin my second story, my friends and I had our own little 1776 moment. Unlike Adams and Jefferson, the challenge that we faced wasn't a crisis, and no, we weren't trying to declare independence from AC administration. That would have been a great story next year. In fact, the challenge that we faced began precisely because there was no crisis, for me at least. My grades were fine, I was getting along with people, I was getting enough sleep, I wasn't stressed out, but that was about it. I started to get this nagging feeling that I could be doing more. I could be growing more, learning more, helping and encouraging other people more. I prayed about this a lot, but I couldn't really figure out what to do. So I decided to tell one of my friends about it. To my surprise, he had been going through almost exactly the same thing. Not only that, but he passed on some pieces of advice that he had been given from the ministry and local members in the congregation. Now, it was just one conversation, but it was the start of something magical. Because over the next few weeks, I started talking to some of the other guys in the study corner, and I discovered that pretty much all of us were struggling with exactly the same thing, as if our clocks were ticking in perfect synchronization. Whether it was time management or academic performance or productivity or sincerity or friendliness, in our own way, we all knew that we could be doing more. So we started working at it together. From then on, if I happened to find a piece of advice in Bible study or in counseling or in some conversation or even in my own thoughts or experience, I couldn't wait to share it with one of my friends because I knew it was probably for them too. And if they found advice, they're also eager to share it with me. We continued to do this for a few weeks, and then one day, I got a nudge. In his orientation lecture during the Singles Winter Weekend, my uncle admonished us to look for the neediest people, because that's the way God thinks. And that was really interesting, because that's exactly the opposite of the way that I normally think. So right then, I made it my daily goal at Singles Winter Weekend to find the neediest people, whoever they were. Suddenly, it was as if I was incapable of having a boring conversation. Each day of the Singles Winter Weekend, I felt like education was streaming at me through a fire hose, and I was doing as much as I could to capture as much as possible. Practical life lessons, miracles, golden nuggets of wisdom, epic stories of courage and facing trials. And somehow, whenever I talked to someone that was in need of encouragement, words flew to mind. And that's weird, because I'm normally terrible at encouraging people. I learned more in those 4 days than I had in the previous 4 months. And most of all, in one of the greatest breakthrough moments of my life, I learned that often it is the neediest people that have the most to give. On the last night of Singles Winter Weekend, I went back to the dorm, started telling some of the guys in the study corner about my breakthrough. To my surprise, they had a lot to tell me as well. In one way or another, each of them had also received a little nudge during that weekend. After weeks of struggling together, we all reached our breakthrough on the same day. It was as if someone had made our clocks to strike at precisely the same second. We talked far later into the night than we probably should have. Don't act like you don't know how that is. Just before we turned out the lights, one of the guys said, "When summer comes and we all change dorm assignments, I'm really gonna miss this group." I couldn't have agreed more. But I also knew that separation would not be the end of our story, Just like separation wasn't the end of the story for Adams and Jefferson. Of course, you've already heard all about that from my cousin, and in case you're wondering, no, we didn't plan that. Our clocks are just in perfect synchronization. Needless to say, Adams and Jefferson spent over two decades on opposite sides of the political aisle. They faced each other in two hotly contested political elections, or presidential elections that you've already heard about. By the year 1812, 36 years had passed since the signing of the Declaration. Both men had retired from politics and settled more than 500 miles apart. Jefferson in Monticello, Virginia, Adams in Quincy, Massachusetts. They hadn't spoken a single word to each other in 11 years. But still, after all this, their bond remained. All they needed was a little nudge. It's one of the most touching scenes in American history. An aging John Adams huddled over a small table. On the table, a piece of paper. And on the paper, a heading. Quincy, January 1st, 1812. Beneath it, Adams wrote a few cordial lines about the new year and his family. Then, his hand trembling with age, he signed the letter and mailed it to Monticello. With that little scrap of paper, 11 years of silence between Adams and Jefferson was broken in an instant. And they picked up right where they left off. A letter from you, responded Jefferson, calls up recollections very dear to my mind. It carries me back to the times when, beset with difficulties and dangers, we were fellow laborers in the same cause, struggling for what is most valuable to man, his right of self-government. After exchanging just a few words, it was as if their old rusty clocks were synchronized once again. Over the next 14 years, 158 letters passed between Quincy and Monticello. You and I ought not to die, said Adams, till we have explained ourselves to each other. So they did. From their homes more than 500 miles apart, the two old friends discussed everything together. They talked of history, politics, education, philosophy, and government, and the Bible. They shared stories, memories, thoughts on their favorite books. They even competed to see who would have more grandchildren. They talked of human nature, world events, speculated about the future, but always, always, again, and again, and again, and again, the conversation returned to the American Revolution, the struggle that had forged their friendship and their nation was one they could never forget. So for 14 years, they continued to talk about it. And at the end of 14 years, one final obstacle remained for them to conquer. On April 17th, 1826, Adams sent his final letter to Jefferson. 14 days later, he was too weak to get out of bed. Jefferson lost consciousness on the night of July 2nd and remained unconscious for two days, after which he awoke with a start and said, "This is the 4th of July." 500 miles away in Quincy, Massachusetts, Adams also awakened from sleep. "It is a great day," he said. "It is a good day." Shortly before his heart stopped beating at 6:20 p.m., John Adams breathed some of his last words. He said, "Thomas Jefferson survives." In fact, Jefferson had already died a few hours earlier. And so it was that on July 4th, 1826, 50 years to the day after America declared independence in 1776, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson staggered across their finish line together. It was as if someone had made their clocks and the great clock of the nation to strike at precisely the same second. So, to the gentlemen in my study corner, Jared, Josh, Elias, and Jeremiah, and to all the rest of you gathered here today, I don't know where we'll be in 36 years, or in 36 million years, but I do know this. If our paths happen to cross somewhere on the fabric of eternity, we'll remember what we overcame together. We'll remember our 1776 moments. And when we do, we'll pick up right where we left off.
The last speeches that we'll hear show just how deeply involved in our lives our Father is. God orchestrates events in a beautiful and in detailed ways to help us grow, to expand our thinking, to help us to aspire to greater ambitions. For our three remaining speakers, God provided experiences that showed them in powerful ways His real purpose in placing us here. In the second speech, we're going to hear from a man who took a very unique and miraculous path coming to Herbert W. Armstrong College. We'll learn how God implanted a hope within his mind and a vision of this very special journey that he would take. And it does remind me of the father of Israel, Abraham, who uprooted and moved wherever God led him because he desired a better country, a heavenly country. You're really going to appreciate the perspective that you gain from this unique story from a junior at God's College, whom I have thoroughly enjoyed getting to know and working with in his time here, giving a speech titled How to Hope. We're going to hear from Mr. Rufaro Manyepa. But before that, we'll hear from a woman who has really dedicated herself wholeheartedly to her experience at God's College. She had to take flight to travel halfway around the world just to get here, and then she had to take to the skies again across an ocean to our sister campus in Edstone, and then again to return here to headquarters. She's going to tell us how she learned to ask for and expect miracles through one of the experiences that she's accumulated during her 4 years at God's College. This is an inspiring and a thought-provoking lesson learned speech given by a student representing the senior class. It's called Take Flight for God. Please welcome Leilani King.
The training an Armstrong College student receives here over the course of 4 years accumulates to over 9,000 hours. If we were to break that down, that would consist of around 4,500 hours dedicated to a work study program, 1,800 hours in the classroom, 1,200 hours for forums, Bible studies, and church services, and about 800 hours for intramural activities. And that's excluding your personal prayer and study each morning. And if you were to get that in, that would consist of roughly 2,300 hours all up. Amid all these hours, this training gives us solid gold opportunities that we can easily overlook. But going through nearly 4 years at AC has reinforced for me how these opportunities are here all around us. And it is our responsibility to seize those opportunities as they come. What exactly am I talking about here? It is the unique golden opportunities we have as Armstrong College students to support the work. I want to share one memorable experience of mine at AC that has reinforced for me how chances to support the work are endless, and they can come in all shapes and sizes. They may come at a time where you least expect it, or where your specific actions alone can determine the course of the work or the open door. But when we see them, we can more deeply grasp the importance of Armstrong College on God's work. It was my sophomore year as a student studying abroad at our sister campus in Edstone, England, and Mr. Furry was due for a trip to Israel where he was able to spend some time with us in England on his way there, which was a wonderful blessing in itself because that Friday night we were able to host a formal dinner for him with the students and the Edstone residents as well as the plane crew. And then the Saturday we were able to hear from him live in the London congregation, which was a wonderful blessing. But for me, it was the Sunday that was the most powerful experience for me as an Armstrong College student. Mr. Flurry was due with his plane crew to leave for Tel Aviv that Sunday morning, and for us students, we made sure all 15 of us were outside ready to send them off, which we did. We farewelled them and we went back inside and continued on with our Sunday morning. I'd also like to add here that Mr. Loco was in town, so he was catching up with Audrey and some work on campus. And I bring him into this because it was about an hour or so later that Mr. Loco received a call to inform us that the plane was not starting and that there were some serious issues with the plane. And if we remember, the pilot encouraged Mr. Flurry to just go home and come back another day to when we could fix the plane. Hearing this news brought an unexpected challenge. And it taught me an important lesson, which is that as an AC student, embrace opportunities to support the work as they can come unexpectedly. Just like it is at Edstone, news spreads really fast. So as soon as Mr. Loco received that call, nearly everyone knew about the situation at hand or were in the process of hunting down Mr. Loco for all the details. I would like to add here that Edstone is 6 hours ahead of time. So by the time we were receiving this news of the situation, everyone here at headquarters were only waking up or in the process of waking up. So no one knew of the situation at hand. So really the responsibility for this miraculous intervention rested on the Edstone residents, with the majority being students of Armstrong College. This presented a faith-building golden nugget opportunity for our students to be on the front lines for the work. As soon as we heard this news, I remember vividly seeing the guys go straight to the dorms to take it to God. And then the girls going to their dorms to take it to God as well. And for me as an underclassman, that was a sobering experience in itself, just to see how quick everyone was to take that situation to God. I personally walked outside and hid behind a few trees overlooking the Edstone Lake. And just looking back at it now, it would have had to be my most sobering, most powerful prayer up until that point, because for me it felt like for the first time ever that prayer alone would determine the course of the work, and that I could ensure that plane left that Sunday to go to Tel Aviv. And as a result of those prayers that Sunday afternoon, and I'm sure of the prayers of those on that plane, the plane was able to miraculously jumpstart and we were able to soar it over to Tel Aviv that Sunday. Mr. Aflari was able to make his trip on schedule without any setbacks, and his meetings with David Beery and Dr. Mazar as well. So as Mr. Aflari was towards the end of his trip in Israel, we were getting ready for our trip to Scotland, to Keep Robbers Cave. So this was about 2 years ago from this day. And it was at this place, at this campsite in Robbers Cave, that we were blessed to hear Mr. Flurry speak live. It was only a 30-minute lecture, but to this day, it was such a wonderful experience to hear fresh off the plane updates from Jerusalem, where he talked about his trip with Dr. Mazar, where we were first introduced to David Beery and the miracles throughout, including the jump-starting of that plane. So for us, it was very personal, and it wouldn't have been as rewarding or personal if we didn't embrace that unexpected challenge the week prior. This taught me yet another lesson, which is that as a result of your contributions to the work, God will bless you with unique opportunities in your college life. Do not belittle the impact that you, as a college student or as a member of the faculty, can have on the work. At the time, I was not baptized, I was a sophomore, and I was working kitchen and custodial, not to put down those jobs in any way, but just to show how it doesn't matter where you are in the body, where you are in the student body, you can make a difference and you can open up doors for the work. So as you go throughout your college and go about supporting your work in your specific department, soar on the path that will allow you to be the best asset for the work. Expect opportunities, but also be willing to embrace those that come unexpectedly. Keep God involved for Him to allow plane starting miracles in your life. Get your feet off the ground and fly to new heights for sacrifices for the work. And as a result, God will fill you with priceless experiences that will propel you beyond the 9,000 hours and make you more thankful for the college and for the work. Take flight for God.
Good afternoon to you all. The Zimbabwean psyche is inherently hopeless. From 1980 until 2018, we were under the rule of Robert Mugabe, a despotic, maniacal ruler who, through corruption and greed, enriched himself and all his cronies and effectively turned a country that was once known as the breadbasket of Africa into nothing more than a basket case. Over the decades of his rule, he contested 6 elections, and he won every single one of them. Well, he lost every single one of them. But because of vote rigging and tampering, he maintained power and he stayed the president. And I just want you to imagine being a Zimbabwean at this time, right? All you've ever known in your entire life is poverty and no future prospects. You don't know what you're going to do for work. You don't know what you're going to eat tomorrow. And the only thing that's supposed to be able to change that is this institution called democracy, right? Where you can change the situation and you can vote in someone else to change your lot and improve your life. But unfortunately, there's a group of people that basically owns democracy. And they don't want the situation to change. They don't want things to be different because they're benefiting from it. And basically, every election cycle at this point is this emotional roller coaster of hope that things will get better, and then disappointment when they never do. Again and again. And at some point, you get to the stage where you realize that the situation isn't going to change, and so you have to. If the disappointment is going to always be there, then it's better not to hope at all, because that just makes it a lot worse. You have to abandon hope. Ladies and gentlemen, today it is my purpose to share with you how God, by bringing me to America, taught me how to hope. Because this psyche, it basically was my starting point in the application to AC. Now, I wanted to come. The idea of coming to AC, that was awesome. I never believed that it would be possible. I didn't think that could actually happen. But by the end of 2017, God had made it pretty clear to me that He wanted me to at least apply. And so I did. Because, you know, it was all about if God wanted me to come to AC, right? If that were the situation, then I knew that I would come. But I needed to find out if He did want me to come first. And I wouldn't allow myself to hope for anything until I knew exactly that. So I refused to even think about AC. I sent in the application. I was like, I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to even imagine it. And that's something that was made all the more difficult because pretty much every 2 weeks, here's Josephine sending me a text saying, hey, did you get your acceptance letter yet? I'm like, I don't want to think about this, Josephine. And, you know, it was just a waiting game at that point. You know, I'm just waiting for the acceptance letter. And on May 16th, of 2018, it came. And, well, it wasn't even really the letter, because the postal system in Zimbabwe is broken. So I actually only got my acceptance letter, the official one, in the mail 2 days before I flew out. That's how bad it was. I got an email. I was sat on my bed and I saw an email from Miss Powell. And I just read the subject line, and it said, congratulations on your A dot, dot, dot. When I tell you that I went berserk in that moment, I sat up out of bed. I started shouting my head off. My mom must have thought I went mad. And I'm pretty sure the neighbors did too, because I bolted out the door and I was running around the neighborhood complex and I was just shouting my head off like, yes! And people were like, what's wrong with this guy? And I'm like, you have no idea. They had no idea. Because what was happening in that moment, it was all those walls that I built up in my mind that stopped hope from existing. In an instant, they were all broken down. In an instant, I started to think and imagine about going to America, coming to AC, how my life would be completely different in every single way, a completely different experience that I've never had in my life. And all of it immediately, because God wanted me here, all of that was possible. The acceptance letter was proof that God wanted me here. It was essentially a promise that if I did my part, God was there willing to do his. He wanted me here. And what is America if not a fulfilled promise? This country itself, that's what it is. That's why it's great. That's why America is America, because God promised something and he made it happen. Because that's what he does. And I tell you what, when I got that acceptance letter, I began to hope. And what does hope do? It inspires action. Right? I did every single thing I could to make sure that I got the visa. Because at that point, it's like, you know, it might take years, like it did for Anthony, to get the visa. But if you know that God wants you there, it's going to happen at some point. And so do everything you can for God to take you where he wants you to be. I walked miles and miles to talk to as many people as I needed to in order to get all the different pieces of documentation, hours on the phone with Mr. Hensley, all the studying I did. I basically memorized all the sets of laws on U.S. immigration to make sure that I knew everything I needed to know. Because at this point, mentally, I was in America already. Even though in body I was in Zimbabwe, mentally I was here. And I needed to do all I could to reconcile the disparity between the mental and the physical. And this was because of God's promise. This was because of hope. And God wanted me to see that. He wanted me here to understand that. He wanted me to know how to hope. And I tell you, from the moment I arrived in America, I saw those promises firsthand. You know, landing at the O'Hare International Airport in Chicago, the Harare International Airport, I think, is maybe just a little bigger than the field house in size. And here I land at O'Hare, where just to get, I have to take a bus just to get to the right terminal. That's basically me every single time I go out in America. You don't even want to imagine what it was like when I went into Walmart for the first time. But when I saw America, I understood these promises. I understood that God made America possible. Without him, it would not be what it is. And that's the big difference between America and Zimbabwe, right? God's involvement. And what would my life be with or without God in it? America. What was Zimbabwe? God wanted me here. He wanted me to see his power. He wanted me to live his power for 4 years. He wanted me to know how to hope, because that hope inspires action. action to get to where God wanted me to be. And if you think about it, we're all essentially Zimbabweans. Because here we are in this world ruled by this maniacal despot who's happy with living, having us live in these terrible conditions, who's happy to oppress us and help us live these lives that just have no happiness in them at all. He's ruined so many lives, and he doesn't care because he's focused on the self. And yet there is a God with all power, who wants us somewhere else. We know where he wants us to be. He wants to take us out of that situation to a place that is completely unlike anything we've ever known. He wants us to see it. He wants us to be there mentally before we're there physically. He wants us to be able to see his power, to see his promises, to know that that's where he wants us to be and that he can achieve that for us. He wants us to do everything we can physically to get there. Because he already wants us there, and he will perform the miracles to take us there. All that action, that vision, the work to reconcile the mental with the physical, the understanding of all these promises from God, all of it starts when we know how to hope.
We come now to our final speech. That hope that we possess, it is a product of the truth that God has given us. What a marvelous thing it is to cherish hope that is based in truth. So even as the world around us convulses in crises, so many of the results of the fraud and deceit that are so prevalent, we can see beauty, we can see blessing, because we see God's hand in our lives. It's not that we're not tested. In fact, this past year, God's church has experienced some serious trials. But the truth gives us understanding. It gives us precious understanding to see the value in those trials. This final speech is a moving personal account, helping us to understand the extraordinary perspective that's conveyed by the author of Psalm 116, which says, "Precious, precious in the sight of the Eternal is the death of his saints." It's been a great pleasure for me to get to know our next speaker during his 4 years at this college, to see the way that God has shaped his experiences and increased his capacity and expanded his vision. I'd like you to give your attention to him now as he shares how saying goodbye to his physical father opened his eyes to his spiritual father. For a heart-to-heart speech titled "The Fingerprints of God," please help me welcome a Herbert W. Armstrong College senior, Mr. Daniel Kokomais.
Thank you, Mr. Hilliker, and hello, everyone. Sometimes the hardest experiences in life actually turn out to be the most beautiful. This was definitely the case in the handful of days that turned out to be the last of my dad's physical life. Through them, I came to see a side of my father that deeply impressed me, that inspired me and motivated me in many ways. And beyond that, there was more to it than just seeing the physical. I saw the intimate involvement of my Heavenly Father in my dad's final days. And in a way, that helped me to come to know him better as well. I have come to see how profoundly beautiful my dad's final days were, and by recognizing how they were touched by the fingerprints of God. And I just want to share a few of those today with you. Now, as hard as it is in the moment, it is beautiful to see your loved one and how he is his entire life kind of take action You know, it's dad in action is how I viewed it. And it was heightened in these last few days. It was really magnified. And God was encouraging us with dad's selflessness, his love for others above himself. And it came in different ways. One way is his humor. If you know my dad, he has a very dry humor, but we still laugh at it. And he used it in a way to encourage us and to motivate us, and it motivated me in many ways. Just wanted to share a few of the stories. There was one point when he was just, all these nurses were kind of getting him set up in the hospital, and he's just talking and talking, and then he starts to give them the family, the Kokomai's family, tomato sauce recipe. The sad thing is, I haven't gotten that yet. Another funny story, this is around the time of the election, and there was a point when he was kind of getting a little uncomfortable, and so the nurse asked my brother, who was there at the time, if she wanted to turn on the TV just to kind of calm him down. So she turns it on, and she goes, "Do you want me to turn on CNN? And my dad just goes, Dad also, at one point, they moved him to another hospital just to, it was a more comfortable hospital for the situation. But putting him in the ambulance, they put him on the track, and they let go too early, and it slid, and it jolted him in the gurney. So then they rush in there, and they're asking if he's okay, and Dad just goes, "Safe!" But that humor was Dad in action. That humor was a fingerprint of God to us, just showing us Dad's nature and how Dad worked throughout his life. He really didn't care for himself. And these last few days, it was magnified. Another way was calming the people around him, not only his family, but the nurses and the doctors who loved him deeply. At one point, his health was kind of taking a turn for the worst. His heart rate monitor was spiking, and the nurses were kind of running around. And he simply grabbed one by the wrist and said, "It's okay, my body's just shutting down. You have nothing to worry about." And to me, in my mind, the nurse is there because you're shutting down. But he didn't care. He wanted them to remain calm, to be okay, to have a smile. And he did that in his humor, his calmness. And really, it helped us a lot as a family. He made sure to call us, every sibling, everyone in the family, at least once every few days, just to talk to us, to receive encouragement, but also to give us encouragement. A miracle God performed was how he wanted to handle things financially, and just in case he did die, he was able to talk to my mom and my brother about it. But a miracle is the next day he lost his speech to where he could only muddle out 3 or 4 words. And that was beautiful to me because you just see how God's preparing him for this final moment. And it really was God shining his light through Dad, helping the nurses, the doctors, helping my family, and preparing us for the inspiring moment. My family received great encouragement through all this, but it even came afterwards. My mom, when she sent out the invites to the funeral, she kept it to just family and members. The neighbors, they're pretty close to them, but they didn't invite them. My mom didn't want to invite them just because of the COVID restrictions and just we didn't know how to handle it. But some of the neighbors showed up. And one of them had moved out about 6 months prior, and we don't really talk to them. We didn't text them or email them, but they still showed up because they heard from another neighbor. And he was a chiropractor, and he canceled his morning appointments to show up to Dad's funeral. Another neighbor mentioned to our family how Dad unified the neighborhood. He would always care for the elderly couple across the street. He would always supply everyone with his humor, his love, his care. And you really got to see Acts 20 and verse 35 come out. As I said, encouragement came in many ways, and for me individually, especially. One thing throughout my life, I just wanted to make my dad proud, being the youngest in the family. Seeing my elder siblings and seeing how proud he was of them. I had prayed for the right attitude in this to see the the joy behind this experience. And my dad's, my last conversation with my dad was the day before he died, and his last words, he was able to muddle, "My good boy, I'm proud of you." And that's a fingerprint of God to me. How God has given me that encouragement now to move forward, to make Dad proud at the resurrection, to be there, but ultimately to see how Dad lived. And that's through being obedient to God, to putting others above the self, and expressing that godly love. And that's what has inspired me. That's a fingerprint to me that I hold deeply. My dad's accomplishments are far too, that list is far too long to list here. But you think of it, all four of his kids graduated from IA. Three, and hopefully four of his kids graduate from AC. Three, and hopefully four of his kids get married. In the last year of his life, he got to spend time with his only grandson. He finally got to see the Cubs win a World Series after 108 years. He married the one he referred to as the love of his life. But the greatest of these accomplishments is finishing his race. And this last fingerprint is the most inspiring of them all to me. After a few weeks and his health continued to decline, the doctors were trying to get more involved, but Dad just said, "No, it's okay. If it's God's will." He chose this path of less involvement from the doctors, and they told us it would probably be a few months. And I probably wouldn't really recover from this. But God blessed us in a way after this decision of just a few hours later, laying in bed with the love of his life, quoting scriptures and sharing their loving and humorous stories together. Mom simply whispered in his ear, in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Minutes later, Dad took his last breath. Dad lived his life in obedience to God, with the hope that we heard about, and the last words he heard was the hope that he believed in. These were the impressions on the mold of Dad. These were God's fingerprints on that mold. These wonderful fingerprints reveal God's presence in my dad's final days of life. God was holding him carefully in his hands, molding and shaping him, finely tuning him for that beautiful moment to seal him. Along the way, he gave my family and myself encouragement. His hands were resting on our shoulders, reassuring us, embracing us. I have to say goodbye to my physical father for a short time. But in this, I've drawn closer to my Heavenly Father, seeing those impressions, his fingerprints all over it. And that's the hope that we have. That is what made this experience so beautiful to me. That is what makes this so inspiring. Coming to see and to cherish the fingerprints of God.
It's been a real pleasure sharing this time together. Thank you very much for your participation as an audience. Thank you to the sophomore class and the kitchen staff for all their hard work in putting this event together. Please, let's express our gratitude with applause. And for really making this event so special and memorable, one more round of applause for our 9 speakers today. And I'd like to conclude with a toast to the AC faculty, God's teachers today, and to the AC students, God's teachers tomorrow. Throughout our days, whether in age or youth, may our hearts seek wisdom, may our mouths speak truth. Thank you very much for coming, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.